Welcome to Pleb Chain Radio, a live show brought to you by Plebs for Plebs, which focuses on the intersection of Nostr and Bitcoin protocols. Join QW and Avi as they run down the weekly news and developments, breaking down the current thing and the future frontier with the foundation of decentralization, the builders, thinkers, doers, and plebs. All right, we are live.
Welcome, gentle plebs, to episode number 77 of Pleb Chain Radio. Today is Friday, the 6th of September, and it is 6:02 p.m. on the east coast of the United States. At the time of recording, we have a great show ahead of you today. Dread, a man of many talents from OpenSats, Flash, and Island Bitcoin, joins us to talk about all of that and much, much more. And just a reminder, if you are listening to this show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, first of all, thank you for listening. But I would urge you to hit pause and switch over to the Fountain podcasting app, where you can earn some sats while listening and support the value for value movement. And of course, our show is recorded live on Nostr.ness, where you can join the live audience and the live chat, which can get fairly lively. Or on zap.stream. And QW, for the meme readout today, I am going to do the trolley problem. Do you know what the trolley problem is, QW?
I don't, but I'm closing my eyes and I'm going to envision this with you, Avi.
Well, before I get to the meme, maybe for you and some of our listeners who might not be familiar, it is a trolley problem is something from ethics, is a thought experiment from ethics and psychology, which poses the question is posed as such. There is a trolley track, or you could think of it as a train track, and it splits at one point into two tracks. There's a lever that allows a controller to decide which direction the train goes in. Right, if the lever's pulled one way, the train goes on one of the tracks. If it's not pulled, it continues on the first track. Right, so the choices are action or inaction. Mm-hmm. So that's the setup. And then on one of the tracks, typically, it's something like a very bad human being is tied to the track, and then on the other track, someone you care about is tied, and the train is hurtling down the track, let's say, of the person that you genuinely care about. Would you pull the lever and divert it onto the track that the bad person is on, right? And it's there's no proper answer to this, because your action by pulling the lever is going to result in the death of a human being, good or bad, right? And who are you potentially to decide to make that judgment, right?
I'm definitely inaction. Saving the one I love.
Right. So that's a basic setup. You can have all sorts of permutations and combinations of it.
Yeah.
If it's on one track, you can have a good person and a bad person. And then on the other track, you can have, right. So you,
but ultimately there's no good choices.
There are no good choices. So that's the trolley problem. The meme, and I would love to attribute this to the person I found this from, but I've actually seen this multiple times in the past as well. It was most recently circulating on Nostr. So I don't want to attribute it to the person who posted it, because it was most likely stolen from the original source. So in this, it's a single frame meme, and there is just one trolley track, QW. It doesn't split ever, right? There's just one track. There is a lever. And there is a person standing next to the lever, and there's a trolley. And on the track, tied to the track, are hundreds of people lined up. And the caption reads, "Pulling the lever changes the color of the trolley from red to blue." And that's the meme. And for our sermon today, QW, let me ask you a question point blank to kick off.
Did that meme have Corn DeLorean's name in the watermark in the corner by chance?
It did not. It did not. I would have called that out if I'd seen it. But for our sermon today, QW, I'm just going to ask you point blank. Do Nostr apps need to be profitable?
I'm of the assumption, obviously, that it's very early. I know it's been it's been over a year and a half now, I suppose, but we're just the users. I wish I knew the cost associated with truly running a relay, and especially like the Nostr.build side of things, where kind of they're the crutch for growth. But I mean, what do you think, Avi? I have my thoughts, but I know you're asking me because you're leading to something here.
Well, let's take a step back here, right? One of the key, if not the key feature of Nostr is the seamless interoperability between all sorts of applications in the ecosystem. And I'm not just talking about the social media Twitter clones, right? You can post something on Fountain that potentially shows up on your Wavelake feed, right? Fountain is a podcasting app. Wavelake is a music streaming app. It can show up on your social media platform, or you can have a long form blogging client, anything, right? You can even build a financial services application if you wanted, and then you could have the communication layer delegated to Nostr and benefit from the interoperability that you get from there. Yeah. So
a medical company, Avi.
More on that.
Pharmacy.
Yes. Yes, and more on that in the coming weeks, QW, on the healthcare side. But so that's a killer feature, right? The seamless interoperability between the apps, and the other one is identity being at the protocol layer, residing in the protocol layer rather than in the application layer, which is the case with legacy tech. Now, so all of that said, right, to have a robust ecosystem of applications, to get the full network effect, right, that flywheel turning, because every time there's a new app, it could potentially, depending on the use case, it brings in new users to that use case, right, and they add to the protocol's robustness. They also feed into the existing apps. Right, and then the protocol gets better as a result of that. More users come in, and then you have the existing users pushing that flywheel further. Right, so to get that full network effect, you need a robust ecosystem of apps. Right, these apps need to be built by developers, but developers need to eat too. Right, surprising as it might sound, these folks have families and they have mouths to feed. And as of now, right, what's allowed these developers to keep the lights on is generous grants, right? That's been the main source of funding and a little bit of venture capital that certainly happened. But, you know, this ecosystem is still in its infancy and certainly at this point dominated by the social media clients. And I haven't seen, I don't know if you have, QW, a viable business model that's emerged for these clients to be profitable, especially if they're taken VC funding. And presumably, at some point, there is an expectation of return, as there typically is on the VC side. So I haven't seen that viable business model emerge yet, just given how early we are. So the question really is, going back to the original question, do these apps need to be profitable yet? At some point, the funding might dry up, right? I mean, what happens then?
What happens if Jack gets hit by a bus, Avi?
that's the thing, right? A lot of the funding, not all of it, certainly, right? There are other gracious benefactors in the space, but Jack Dorsey is the elephant in the room. When it comes to funding a lot of Nostr development through various conduits, right, nonprofits and so on and so forth. So what happens then? So I'll round it out. There's no good answers there, and hopefully that never happens, and Jack continues to be as gracious as he's been with his grants. But let me ask you another question, KW. right, let's take a step back into history. What was the 1 year return on capital on the Sistine Chapel, or the 5 or 10 year return on capital? And I ask that because clearly that was an incredibly resource intensive project, and right. someone had to put up the funds. So what do you think their return on capital was in, let's say, the 5-10 year time frame?
You have the answer to that? Because I don't.
I would say, well, I it is close to, I'm willing to bet it's close to zero, right?
Yeah,
the 1 year.
Yeah.
But what is the 500-year rate of return?
But you're equating a movement, just like the, you know, that chapel in general, to our citadel in a way, correct?
The point I'm trying to get at is the 500-year rate of return on mm-hmm. the Sistine Chapel is right. priceless, because the culture endured. That's yes. what the Medicis and the other benefactors and the patrons ensured, right? These building these incredible monuments, it preserved the culture, and its value is priceless. And that's how I view these free and open protocols like Bitcoin and Nostr. They are monuments to freedom, and we right. need the Medicis of our day to step up and think in that low time preference manner.
Yeah, and I 100% agree. And I think that if you think Nostr is inevitable, and it's an open protocol that anybody can build on. Obviously, the time preference is, you know, funding does accelerate the time preference. It does fund the toys of now. But in the long run, I mean, I can see a lot of this, just like that chapel might have been. There's a higher purpose. I think, you know, a lot of the devs are working on the side with this, you know, based off. If you've seen it, then you can't unsee it. If you know what Nostr is, you know the incredible interoperability, the freedom it gives, all the things we've talked about. There certainly is a little bit of a moral obligation, I feel, to work on something like this. So you get that reciprocity when you put your work in. You know, like tomorrow, my wife today was doing a bake. There's a bake sale at a homeless dog shelter tomorrow. She's baking away today. She's applying her craft to a higher purpose. And I think there's something to be said about that beyond monetization. Of course, she's not doing that full time, but, you know, she couldn't make money off that if she's actually donating her time to a higher purpose, such as puppies that don't have a home, Avi. So those are some of the things I think about as well. And, you know, maybe, you know, if we were basing it off of just your donated time, obviously our time preference is going to be, it's going to take longer. But, you know, donations do help. All the funding does help. And all it does is buy more time for devs today versus pushing it off. So in the end, I believe we get to the same end goal. It's just a matter of what window of time we get there.
Yeah. So the short answer then to the
is Nostr apps aren't profitable today.
Do they need to be?
And God bless you.
Exactly.
But I think ultimately everything I've seen, if we're not going to go with the if Nostr's not going with, let's say, the advertising model today, and maybe that'll change. I mean, I think all these clients are going to have a crossroads one day when they get scale large enough, and they're not maybe the Zaps are drying up or the donations aren't there. I mean, I always think value works with quantity. You need the scale, you need the plebs. So it's something that, you know, if maybe that's not the route, because we are experimenting on that end too. So it's just something where there might be some bridges that some of these clients have to cross. And we saw it with, you know, just Twitter. They went public, then there was a board, and, you know, then you're slave to shareholders. I mean, these are all things that I think client the freedom of Nostr kind of protects the users against that. But you know, who knows what'll happen in the future?
Who knows, indeed, QW. Any final answers to the question, or have you already answered it?
I mean, I wonder if like someone like Fountain might be profitable yet, because they do the subscription model, $2.99 a month. I mean, there might be some that are out there that might be a little bit profitable, but we're also talking about, you know, Bitcoin. You know, what you save today is going to be worth X amount in the future. So that could be something as well. Few and far between, if any, is the
what you save today is going to be about 58K forever, QW.
That's a stable coin. It's the Costco hot dog of currency. One BTC equals one BTC, Avi.
All right. Well, it's time to welcome our guest today, Dread. Welcome to Plebchain Radio.
Greetings, and thank you very much, and give thanks to the Most High.
I love that. So, Dread, we've got to start with a burning question. What is or what was the pole vault dream?
This is appropriately timed since the Olympics just completed in Paris. I've been for probably the younger and more fit half of my life a professional pole vaulter. And for those in the audience wondering what pole vault is, it is a event in track and field in athletics where you run with a very long fiberglass pole. The longest I've ever had was about a 16'5". It's about a 5-meter pole. And you run as fast as you can, stick it into a hole in the ground, throw your body forward hard enough to bend that fiberglass almost in half, and then catapult yourself way up in the air to clear a random plastic bar. or I think the bar was fiberglass too. To show the world how high you can go as a human being. And I was elite. My highest jump was about 17'4¾". I made the NCAAs in the US in my college. I held my national record for about 11 years in Jamaica. And I retired not making the Olympics, but the dream, the pole vault dream, was to make the Olympics and win it. So the dream is still alive, even though I am retired now. So I keep my namesake to, you know, let you know that if you have a passion, you go for it. And even if you don't hit your passion, you know, that phrase of aiming for the stars and landing on the clouds is very true for me. I was able to travel the world as a professional pole vaulter and see a lot of places I wouldn't have otherwise seen, including Europe. So I'm very grateful for that opportunity and that experience I've had earlier in my life.
That's an incredible story, Dredd. I actually had no idea. I was just reacting to the handle that you use on a couple of your social media accounts, Spole Vault Dream. I had no idea that you almost made the Jamaican Olympics team.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see you go up against Mondo in 28 in LA. Dredd, let's do it.
So here's another funny story for you. Mondo, Armand. I've been watching him since he was probably about 10 or 11 years old.
Wow.
My professional career started in Florida, but then I moved to Louisiana to train with some of the professional coaches there because Louisiana, if you didn't know, is one of the hot spots for pole vault in America. Some of the best coaches and the best generational coaches in the world are down there, both in track and field, but particularly in pole vault. Mondo's dad was one of those coaches, and out by LSU he used to train, and his kid would be out there running around, you know, playing kickball and playing with the other kids, and just picked up pole vault. And he was breaking records since he was a teenager, since he was 12 and 13. He was jumping a foot higher than almost every other kid there. So I've watched him from the beginning, and we've always said that he's going to be the next greatest thing, like the Usain Bolt of pole vault. And here he is now, breaking.
He would blow me away. I'm not like some diehard track and field viewer, but I did catch his finals, and I saw his dad in the audience, just kind of as his kind of crutch. But that was a beautiful performance.
And QW, Mondo is not the gentleman whose family jewels interfered with his pole vault dream, right?
No, that was, I can't think of a name for it.
You know what I'm talking about, right, Dredd?
Yeah, he definitely made pole vault great on social media again for a short amount of time.
Did you confuse him with Mandingo, Avi? Carry on, Avi. Sorry.
No. This is actually, we got a much better story than I expected from this thread for what was meant to be a throwaway question. I had no idea. So let's talk about your pleb story, Dredd. How did you get to where you are? What is that journey like to get here today? Get into Bitcoin and Noster and everything else that you're doing.
Yeah, well, I've always been a techie. My dad is an engineer, classically trained in New York, and has been doing computer work since I can walk. He's sold computers and typewriters and everything else he can think of in Jamaica. So I grew up around it, and I was, you know, studying for computer engineering throughout college during my pole vault dream. So when the pole vault thing kind of ended, I dove into my engineering career a lot more. became a senior manager in one of the top four firms in the US, and then started my own firm. So I have a deep engineering and, you know, corporate background when it comes to that kind of stuff. So I've always had my ear to the ground, and some of my colleagues talked about Bitcoin back in, I think, 2017, when the price was jumping up a lot again. And I did the same thing everybody else did. You know, I bought some Bitcoin, bought some other shit coins, thought I knew everything, and, you know, was trading back and forth for probably 3 or 4 or 5 months until everything was crashing. But throughout that short time, I started, you know, the reason I started buying Bitcoin in the first place is because I saw, you know, the promise of digital money. So it kind of confused me as to why everything started crashing and what I missed about this. Like, why am I suddenly in, you know, Wall Street style trading with a bunch of other degens? And it was in the bear market of 2018 that I really, you know, was able to understand what Bitcoin was. That's the first time I actually read the white paper. I probably lost 5 figures before reading the white paper. So I would advise everyone, read the white paper first. If you're a technical anyway, it helps to separate a little bit of the the degen feeling you might have. It sparks your curiosity, is what I would say, as opposed to just we're thinking about the money. But from there, my Bitcoin journey began. I spent the next 2 or 3 years listening to, God knows, thousands of podcasts and articles. I've probably listened to everything Guy Swan has read on podcasts from the beginning. I've read almost everything Parker Lewis has written. I took the Austrian economics course from Saifedean Ammous when he first started it. So I really went deep down the rabbit hole trying to understand, because it didn't make sense to me. I'm coming from a, you know, very colonized, you know, believe what you're told, you know, full on kindergarten straight through formal high school education programming, right? So there was a lot of unprogramming that needed to happen for me to really understand what was happening, not just in Bitcoin, but in the world. So it was an awakening for me. And then from there, I realized that Bitcoin was freedom technology, because it freed me from thinking a certain way. And I really got caught in my new passion after pole vault now was, you know, learning more about freedom technology and then using it. So when Noster came around, which was, I think I was the first November of Noster, I jumped in. I saw the craziness from Fiat Jaff, and a bunch of people were jumping on. And I jumped on early. I think I, you know, messed up my NSTEC at the time. I posted it on one of those insecure web-based platforms at the time. I think it was Astral.Ninja or what? I remember the one now.
Enigma.
That was unsecure? Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah. No, there was like 2 or 3 of them. It wasn't Astral. It was a different one. It was
Enigma, right? Dredd, I remember that one.
I think it was Enigma. I think it wasn't. They made a public statement saying that the NSTECs were insecure. So
yeah,
I had to burn that account, but it's still there.
It's good to get rugged at the beginning though, right?
Yeah. Early ruggings are good. Stove
right off the bat.
But since then, you know, because I had the thinking about freedom technology already when I saw Noster, and I realized that at the same time, it was almost at the exact same time, people were being banned and censored on X and YouTube. Nostr pops up and people are posting anything they want on that. That was the first aha moment. But the second aha moment was moving my NSEC from, you know, that breached web client to like Damas, and it just working with all my followers still there. So that was like, okay, this is not just an app anymore. And that's what I'll say to your earlier sermon around, you know, Nostr apps needing to be more, needing to be profitable, or needing to be anything. And I come from it from a different angle, where I don't consider Nostr apps as needing to even exist as just an app, apart from a very small window. It's like, you know, money. Like, there are money apps that exist for a very small client that, you know, want to either bank themselves, or they're trying to trade their money for crypto or Bitcoin or stocks or whatever. They're trying to do different trading things with the instrument. But apart from that, the majority of apps that have money in them are using some other utility, right? You use the money to buy your pizza, to get an Uber, to, you know, pay for your movie, to buy your Netflix. All of these things use money, but they're not money apps. So I would say, outside of a very small window of apps we're talking about, I consider Nostr and Bitcoin to be, you know, innovations, or I would say more like discoveries, right? Like, we had Fire was one of the first discoveries of man. We didn't invent Fire, but we discovered it. And there's so many different utilities that happen because of that. You know, same thing with radioactive elements, same thing with harnessing electricity. We discovered how to do it. And then we didn't just have an electricity, you know, contraption. We used it for many different utilities, right? And then same thing for communication across all of us. Like, the printing press was the first real discovery that I would call it. I know it's an invention to a certain extent, but I think we discovered it, right? We discovered how to decentralize the printing of information. And then in the digital age, the internet is a protocol that we discovered how to use, right? And that allows us to digitize that kind of printing press, decentralize it. So I consider Bitcoin and Nostr to now be layer twos of that, right? Where it's like, we've discovered how to decentralize communication, decentralize money, and we should now use this discovery to enhance every single application that's out there that we're already using, right? We should, yes, have the small focus on, you know, the protocol-based apps that are actually just doing Nostr stuff, or actually doing money stuff. But even this, like, this is not a Nostr app to me. This is a live stream that's happening, right? PlebChain Radio, it's happening on Nostr Nests. And Nostr Nests is a media, decentralized media platform that we're all using to talk to each other. It's not a Nostr app, but it uses Nostr, the discovery, right? And it's the same thing with Damas. Damas is a social media app. It just uses Nostr, the discovery. And I would love if we did that as a focus for what we build. So everything we build now can have a utility that we were already using or that we can use. And Nostr is just a superpower that it has to continue moving forward and to, you know, to blow everything out the water that used to use that utility before. So yeah, that was kind of in my journey now. And I am focused on making a product that does that, that has a utility in my home island and my Caribbean region, but it uses the superpowers of Bitcoin and the superpowers of Nostr to blow everything else out the water that's doing what I'm doing, which is remittance, circular economy, payments, and buying and selling of Bitcoin.
You know, I love how you framed that, Dredd, about them being discoveries, Bitcoin and Nostr especially, right? And everything else prior to that. And I know perhaps you meant it somewhat metaphorically, but I can bring it even, in the case of Nostr especially, I can make it even more literal, right? The NPUB, NSEC, KeyPair relation, it's a mathematical relationship that has always existed, right? The Schnorr signatures that tie the two together is just that we developed the language to describe that relationship recently. So yeah, in some sense, NSEC, I mean, in a very strong sense, NSECs are, and NPUBs are discovered. And with that comes the identity that's tied to whoever's made the discovery, right? Which then is portable across any use case.
Absolutely. Same thing with the seed phrase, right? The seed phrase already existed for Bitcoin. You just found it and started using it.
Right. you discovered your bank account as a result.
Yeah.
Love it.
So are there any similarities between pleb culture and Rastafari or Rastafarian?
I would say yes. Yes and no. The commonalities would be that we definitely pride ourselves in not striving for the blue check, not wanting to, you know, be in the ivory tower away from the pros. Like the Rastaman has always been self-sufficient, has always been a self-learner, a self-teacher as well for the community, and not necessarily trying to be selfless, but because selfishness is not a bad thing in our culture either. You're selfish because you need to take care of yourself. You need to be able to provide for yourself. So I think plebs are very similar, where, you know, the pleb doesn't depend on the Twitter blue check, or the pleb doesn't depend on, you know, the likes to need to be popular. The pleb, you know, just does what he does, where we keep it weird. So I think Rasta is very similar to that. They don't condone, when you kind of file in line and follow everyone else, you know.
Conform.
Thank you. We're the rebels. So I would say that's the commonality. The differences are that the Rasta is a bit more uniform in terms of belief and, you know, the type of religious, historical tenets that they would follow in order to, you know, be pious in a certain way. There's different levels of Rastafarianism. Some are very orthodox, some are very liberal, but overall they still follow a general path of belief. And I would say that the plebs are a little bit more free form. Like, there is no monolith of plebs. If you're a pleb, you're a pleb. You're just not something else. You're not part of the, you know, the ivory tower, you know, uniform, following rules, people that don't think for themselves. I would say that's the general thing I would say is, as a pleb, you think for yourself. You could still be elite in many ways. You could still be the top 0.1% or whatever, but I think if you're a free thinker, you're naturally just a pleb.
Right. So here's one for you. Tell me about block height 789539.
Oh man, that block, I have it engraved on a bracelet now. That block height was the exact block that my son came into the world. That was about 16 months ago.
Yeah, my son's 19 months. So
nice. What block height?
I don't have it remembered, but I have it written down. I should have it remembered. It's pretty, because I was planning on either tattooing it, or you went the jewelry route. So I need to put it somewhere, and then I'll remember it every day. So, but that's a beautiful thing. And I think you've celebrated that would be your first Father's Day, right?
First Father's Day, correct.
How's that changed your life?
Oh, it's turned it upside down, that's for sure.
I feel you, man.
But no, it's a blessing. I'm happy every day. And I'm happy every day before this too. I think everything I've done has led to this point. And I'm blessed, and I'm, you know, very appreciative of what the world has given me so far. And I hope to give back just as much, if not more, before I leave.
Yeah. And it really activated me for his future versus just mine alone. You know, it's something that that kind of changes your perspective, certainly changes your perspective on how you want to leave the world for someone that you love. So,
yeah, it's like you're living for them now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Highly recommend it. More Generation B pleb babies. Let's go.
Yep. Five stars.
So, you worked, tell me about your work at PlebNet.
Yeah, so I know you had Mads on recently, and that was an amazing time that we went through with Hierarchy D++, P. A bunch of us were there just kind of you know, shuffling in the dark, trying to figure it out. And Lightning was so new, even though it was mainnet now. It wasn't testnet anymore, but it was still so new, and there wasn't much documentation and or many people out there to ask questions to. So PlebNet wasn't really a job. It was always just a time in my life where I actually found myself having both the time and the curiosity to really dig into this. And then a bunch of other people with that were in the same position. So we would go, you know, 24, maybe not. Yeah, maybe if we're swapping in and out 24 hours straight, just, you know, opening channels and figuring out problems and spinning up nodes. And it became a thing where we knew so many of the problems and the nuances that we became a small group of people everyone else was asking to help. And I think that was the real true binding glue of PlebNet from the beginning. It wasn't us learning. It was when we figured it out, everyone else was like, okay, what did you do? How'd you get this to work? Because it's, you know, new and no one else knew. And we realized, okay, well, I think we're kind of the, you know, lack of a better word, the authority on how to pleb create a Bitcoin Lightning node and spin it up so that you have liquidity that you can actually spend from it. That was the main problem. And when I was doing it by myself, I'd set up some nodes and I'd set up some channels on them, and I couldn't actually figure out how to get it to reliably make a payment, right? In terms of liquidity, in terms of channel size, in terms of fees, in terms of uptime, Tor connections, you name it. And the combination of people in PlebNet really made that possible for anyone. As long as you joined our group and just asked a few questions, you would just be handed a, you know, white glove hand that would walk you through the process until you have a node up and running and well funded. So that was an amazing experience. I think I learned that from that. I learned when you have a community, like a community that really cares about what they're building or what they're learning or what they're trying to do, it's more powerful than any company that you can build, you know, because you have, it's almost like you have an individual CEO in every person in the group that cares about what they're doing, and they don't need instruction. You know, they don't need a path or a plan. Like, no plan started for the first year. There was no plan for PlebNet. It just organically grew into a wiki, into a support channel, into a emergency channel. If your node was crashed, they would have like specialized people in there to help you recover the node. We got, you know, almost direct immediate support from LND, from Lightning Labs, from Bosworth, because, you know, we were just curious and not asking for anything except for knowledge. So I would say I've seen the same thing in Noster. That's what Noster reminded me of, is PlebNet. When I saw people that were so passionate about making this work and just wanted to learn more about it and teach more about it and use it. And yeah, that's what I would compare it to in terms of how it felt in the early days of PlebNet.
And where is, and it's about a 900 or 1,000 person strong community, is that right, Dredd? Or at least that's the number of nodes that are part of the PlebNet, I guess. What is it, the community? Yes.
A 1,000 nodes, but the community was about 6,000 strong.
Wow.
And because a lot of the nodes we had were also Tor, and they didn't all announce themselves. So it was a pretty strong network. It still is a pretty strong network. I've since left Telegram, and I'm working on leaving Twitter. That's a bit more organization needs to be done in my DMs first, move people over from my DMs so I don't lose their contact. And then I'm probably also going to be off Twitter. But the last time I checked on Telegram, it was 6,000 strong, and we had spread to Discord and Matrix, and hopefully we get off Telegram completely and we can, you know, PlebNet can live on Noster. I know that Mads talked about the wiki needing to be resolved, and I hope that we could use, I think it's npub.pro, or I forgot the name of that. Is it npub.pro?
It is, yeah.
Okay, that would be an amazing place to service.
Yeah,
to put the wiki.
Nice. So Dredd, you know, you've mentioned in the past, or you maybe written about living the nomadic lifestyle. What have some of your experiences been And what tips would you share with folks who are looking to do the same thing?
Hmm.
You might have even just been traveling nomadic.
I think it was more traveling nomadic for me versus actually living the lifestyle. I don't think I ever fully got into the lifestyle, but I was close.
You didn't get in a van between 2019 or 21, like a quarter of our guests.
No van for me. But I would say the way I did it is much more from a, what would I call it? Take a year off and you know, explore places type approach. I still had my base that I would come home to and, you know, have family and friends and a place to recover. But I would take, you know, two month long trips to places to explore. And that was exciting for me. I think it's always amazing when I learn something new about a culture that I thought either didn't exist or, you know, wasn't ever the norm anywhere in the world, and it expands your mind. So I one of the things I tell everyone is travel. If you can do anything else, travel, you know, to anywhere. And once you start traveling, you'll know where else you want to go and where you don't want to go. But I think traveling is one thing that someone should always do before they kick the bucket.
Can I ask, when you adopt Bitcoin as your perception, does it change? I guess, does it change your perception when you travel, when you look around?
Yes and no. I think there's still always wonders that you're always going to be amazed or disappointed in across the world, regardless of Bitcoin. But then Bitcoin puts like a lens on your glasses, you know, like augmented reality, where you can just see certain things through the matrix now. That's what I would describe Bitcoin. It also opened doors in many interesting places that I didn't expect it to. Because, you know, traditionally Bitcoin has been a taboo subject in many countries. So you go and you talk to people, and if you're able to find the Bitcoin community in that area, you're probably also going to find a very unique community that is niche or on the edges, and it can be a lot of fun. It also can be kind of dangerous if you're, you know, not careful, but it's definitely always going to be an adventure. It's not going to be your boring run-of-the-mill touristy. Like, I did articles for Bitcoin print magazine, the first four episodes they had, or four issues they had. I flew to Ukraine, Amsterdam, El Salvador, and I was able to really walk around and find the Bitcoin underground communities, or above ground. In Amsterdam's case, it was a huge community there, and but Ukraine was more underground, and it was really cool to see that in different ways Bitcoin is seeping, this discovery is seeping into all the utilities without needing a Bitcoin app to be, or a Bitcoin, you know, banner to be waving anywhere. So traveling showed me that in terms of the lens of Bitcoin, everything I looked at, I could see Bitcoin slowly coming into it in different areas, but definitely not mainstream. Like, we're so early. We're so early for Bitcoin across the world.
We certainly are, Dredd. So let's, but talking about being early and trying to do something about that, you have an app called Flash. Out in the Caribbean. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? What is the app? What does it do? And there is some kind of Nostra integration, I heard you mention, in Madeira. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So Flash is the way I'm trying to connect the Caribbean using Bitcoin. Today, the Caribbean is a bunch of different islands all across the Caribbean Sea, and, you know, some coastal countries as well. And we all have, well, not most of us have different currencies. Most of us have different central banks and, you know, different ways that we are able to send and receive money. And Flash is going to solve three problems for people in the Caribbean. One, it's going to try to reduce the friction of remittance. Today, people spend anywhere from 5 to 10% sending money home via Western Union. And there's a lot of friction in KYC and, you know, fear of theft and et cetera, et cetera. Also, in general, banking in Jamaica just sucks across the Caribbean in general. I always give the example of you have to pay a fee just to deposit your money in the bank. I'm not talking about through an ATM. Even if you walk into the bank and hand them your money, they're taking a fee just for that action. It comes from a very outdated banking system that they purposefully have not upgraded because it would not be in their financial interest. So I think that similar to cell phones, where Jamaica kind of leapfrogged the whole landline infrastructure to do cell phones across the whole island, I feel like Jamaica is also going to leapfrog the digital banking era, because we're all still almost analog in Jamaica in terms of banking. There are no APIs. So we're leapfrogging that and going straight to Bitcoin, in my opinion. And that's what Flash is trying to push for. And then the third thing is also giving Jamaicans access to buy and sell Bitcoin in Jamaica and across the Caribbean. We know today, if you have a Jamaican debit card, Visa, MasterCard, whatever it is your bank is giving you in Jamaica, your card will not work on Coinbase. Your card will not work on Binance. Your card will not work on any one of the platforms that allow for international users to buy and sell Bitcoin. So the average Jamaican has no easy way to use an exchange with their local money and buy Bitcoin or sell Bitcoin. They have to go on peer-to-peer markets. And we all know how hard those are to find. I know Nostr is solving some of it, but Nostr is very niche. So I'm trying to give the general public in Jamaica and the Caribbean at large an easy way to use their local currency and get some Bitcoin and hold on to it, or use it at your local supermarket, or use it at your local gas station, or put it on a Bolt card, and which we're calling Flash cards. We've kind of did some custom printing like Marcy did. No faces, though. This is all like Jamaican colors and stuff. And you can just walk around with a Bolt card and pay for things using Bitcoin. And if we can, if the product can seep into the culture so that people realize this is something that they can use without needing to depend on the banks or without needing to depend on Western Union, then I think we will have achieved our goal of connecting Jamaica and the Caribbean to the Bitcoin network and the open monetary network there is out there, to allow them to do international trade, to allow them to send money home from their, you know, loved ones, and to allow them to participate in this sound money revolution that everyone else in the world is currently participating in and that we are currently locked out of.
Amen to that, man. You know, if Jamaica can adopt a bobsled team, they can definitely adopt Bitcoin, right?
Cool.
I love that movie growing up, by the way. not to get into it. Avi, what's up?
No, I was good. What is the Nostr integration? I remember there was, I think in Madeira at Bitcoin Atlantis earlier this year, there was a pitch day, right? And you were pitching Flash, and you'd mentioned a Nostr integration of some sort.
Yeah, so we're using open source tools across the board, right? From the stack, from the bottom up, we're all open source. And part of our open source tool is trying to open source the chat feature. Our Flash wallet or Flash app, because it's an app that contains four different things. It contains two wallets. It is a custodial wallet for ease of use and a non-custodial wallet for savings. It also contains a map feature where you can see on the map interactively where all the different Flash points are. These are places you can get physical dollars or trade it in for cash for Bitcoin. And then it also contains a chat feature. And the chat feature is basically Nostr DMs. That's where we're starting right now. Nostr DMs and one Nostr support group. So if you are on the app for the first time and you click on the chat window, you're going to see one support window. And all of our support, basically think, you know, Zendesk or one of those different support, you know, platforms, but we're just doing it in a Nostr group instead. So it's a public group. Anybody can ask questions in there. We'll answer direct questions. But if you have anything that's personal or sensitive that you need to ask, we'll go into a DM with you. And that's the other part of the chat window. It's DMs. And this is the reason why I'm excited about what we're doing, but also why it's been a struggle. If you know about DMs in Noster, it's been a journey. we started off with Nipple 4, which wasn't really DMs. You know, it was just messages that were kind of encrypted, but metadata was all over the place. And then it moved into what was kind of NIP 44, which was encryption, but not necessarily DMs. And then we now have, we kind of try to, are you okay if I'm explaining the technical part of this?
Please. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. We tried to adopt what Signal did, which is double ratchet encryption. And that's, you know, super secure for Signal. Might be a little bit on the heavy side to adopt everything they did. So at the protocol level, the devs, you know, Jeff G and these guys are the ones that are doing all of this, but I'm technical enough to follow along. They decided to adopt the double encryption part, but used gift wrapping as a way to hide the metadata. So it's a combination of NIP 44 right now and NIP 56, which is a gift wrapping, to create a new NIP called NIP 17. And that's what the versioning, the versioned DMs are as it stands. That's the one that we are using in Flash. So we're fairly confident now that you can, you know, DM directly with your fellow Flash user. It's using NIP 17 as its standard for DMs. But I do know that coming down the line, that messaging layer security is coming, MLS, which is, I think, NIP 104. And that's like the gold standard for what we really want DMs to be. And the reason I go so deep into this is because we're, you know, having people send a lot of money on our app, and they're communicating directly with each other, even businesses, and they're talking about finances, about money. So I don't think it's as free form as, you know, just you and your friends shitposting and you have DMs with each other. I think when you're starting to talk about finances, it would be nice to have as secure of a DMs platform as possible. And anything short of centralizing it is what I want. And MLS seems to be the gold standard for that. So when MLS does get released, we're planning on implementing it. But for now, Flash does have NIP 17 implemented. And on our next release, right now we're in release 0.2, which is you know, our first ever production release. And it has a stabilized USD custodial wallet. It has a non-custodial wallet on Breeze SDK. And it has the map feature. And version 0.3 will have the chat feature, which has NIP 17 DMs and a support group that you can use. The future roadmap for it is the sky's the limit, because it's Noster, right? Like, Noster is not the app. Noster is the discovery, and we can build so much stuff on top of that. So my exciting part about this is now you have a community you're building, and you guys can do, you know, community lending. You can do partner draw, which is a, you know, a community-based susu, or I don't know what they call it in different countries, but it's basically community group lending and paying back based on a rotating period of time. You can also do flash lending across the community if you need to pay for something immediately. And then the biggest thing that I'm excited about is marketplaces. I saw a few different places, Pleb Marketplace, kind of try this, but I think some kind of micro version of it would be amazing that can just plug into all kind of different apps. So my excitement about the future of Noster is how many of these micro utilities will automatically get plugged into apps just because we're already connected to Noster. But that's the Noster part of our app. It's really communicating as well as using Bitcoin.
I love the fact that you have custodial and self-custody or non-custodial options on there as kind of a default, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, because I never thought custodial was a bad thing. It just needed education. You can't have the trust in custodial. And I think education about what custodial truly is, the chance of rugging, it turns it into a, this is my pocket going out a night out versus your savings, which obviously you would never risk getting rugged. So I don't know if I know where that's a default on any wallet out there.
Well, it recently became, well, default. No, I don't think it's a default on any wallet out there. Recently, a few wallets tried it. Mutiny, Bull Bitcoin, a few others, but it hasn't been a default. When I first started developing it, I'd never heard of it before, but it was a use case that I found here. You know, people in Jamaica wanted the immediate access to Bitcoin so they can buy and sell and receive things quickly because, you know, when you're working hard and you don't have much time, time is of the essence. You don't have 10, 15 minutes to wait for a confirmation. But at the same time, they also wanted to take part in the non-custodial world, in the, you know, the unruggable world. And it's a shame that you always have to download two completely different apps and learn two completely different processes to do so. So we built it so that once you have money in any one of your wallets, it's a one-click process to move it to the other one for a very small fee.
Well, and having a default makes a layman say, well, what's that other wallet? And you start learning about the, you know, the difference between the two, because a lot of people just say, I have Bitcoin, and they don't know what the wallet they're holding it in, you know, and then it just disappears one day and they're like, Bitcoin's a scam. You know, it's having that default, I just think, is a smart tactic for education in general, because it does get you wondering.
So Dredd, let's move on and talk about Island Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's another thing coming soon, right, Avi? The website, at least.
Yeah, Island Bitcoin is very in its very early stages. I think we've had seven across the last year. The first 6 months it was very sporadic Bitcoin meetups, but for the past 4 months now we've had a meetup every month. And we've also had a games night every other Thursday where we play Hoddle Up, a board game that is an amazing Bitcoin learning board game for people who don't even understand Bitcoin. Funny story. We're at the last meetup last month, and we're playing Hoddle Up. We're setting it up on, and it's at a bar, right? So there's people walking around. There's a salsa dancing class about to happen next door. You know, just social environment, right? And two randos walk up, not Bitcoiners, just people. They look at the board game and they're like, what are you guys playing over there? Thinking it's Monopoly or something. So we say, no, it's Hoddle Up. It's a game that, you know, you play to have fun, but you also learn about Bitcoin. And they sat down and they played with us. And I swear to you, within maybe 20 minutes, first, one of the players was winning, like understood the mining situation better than even me, and was winning strategy-wise. And second, asked more about Bitcoin. Like by the end of the game, they were both downloaded Flash. They both had Bitcoin on their wallets. They had a Bolt card, and they were asking where they could spend it and how they could, you know, become part of the community. So
amazing.
You know, huge shout out to Hoddle Up for making a game that, you know, anyone can understand. But that kind of gives you an idea of where we are, right? We're just a fun community of, you know, open doors, and people who want to come and learn more about Bitcoin can. Eventually we'll have a BitDevs hackathons, but in general it's going to be a nonprofit that doesn't really do anything except share knowledge and have fun doing it. And Jamaica is just the beginning. Island Bitcoin is a Caribbean movement, so there's a lot of other communities around the Caribbean that have already made strong roots, and we've contacted them, and we just want to help them to grow. It's all, you know, one movement. So if Island Bitcoin can help Cuba, can help Dominican Republic, can help Puerto Rico, can help Bahamas, Martinique, Montserrat, all of these different islands that already have communities, we're just going to funnel resources and advice and information their way, and let this region that I love so much become, you know, aware. And you know, they'll be some rando genius kid that ends up blowing all of us out the water from the Caribbean that no one's heard of. And I just wait for that day.
That's pretty great, huh, Avi? You know, when we look at where the culture kind of expands from Hayek to cypherpunks to to a white paper. Now we're to the point now where we're expanding through board games, cartoons, just anything that's that touches culture can have a message of Bitcoin through it. And I think the underlying is just freedom is infectious. So yeah, I just had to reflect on that for a moment.
Huddle Up, no, and Huddle Up is a really good game. As you said, Dredd, big shout out to Scott and Tali.
Yeah, Free Market Kids is an amazing company. Big shout out to them.
For sure. So let's talk about the other big thing that you're working on, Dredd, OpenSats. What is your role there?
So I am one of the 9 board members at OpenSats. And my role is to, you know, one, make strategic decisions at our quarterly meetings, and then also directly vote on every application that comes in for a grant. For anyone that wants to know about OpenSats, it's opensats.org. We are a US-based 501c3 charity, nonprofit that donates grants to open source software developers, especially Bitcoin, but also focused on Noster, Lightning, education, outreach, and research. And I'm proud that we are, you know, single-handedly sponsoring 200 different grantees for projects or individuals, and several long-term support grantees for Bitcoin Core, Lightning, and Noster that get multi-year, you know, grants to have them have a secure funding source for continuing the important work we're doing building out these discoveries.
So could you explain the difference, Dredd, to folks who might not understand between what your long-term funding grant is and what your regular grant process or grant is?
Yeah, sure. So the way I like to look at it is it's more around, you know, well, I split it up into 2 different areas. Let's talk about first the, you know, protocol and spec level work that's being done in the FOSS space. And then there's more of the, you know, application layer and productizing and you know, all the peripheral services as well, like media, et cetera, around the Bitcoin space. When it comes to the spec level and the protocol level, I think that kind of plumbing and infrastructure work is super important for us to really build this out and scale it, you know, to the masses. And that work is usually gone unrewarded, right? That's like, that's the dirty work that no one really wants to do. It's very hard, and you're not gonna build a $1 billion Twitter off of that, right? It's the spec work that the Core Lightning people are doing, and it's the spec work that the Lightning Labs people are doing, and it's the Bitcoin Core developers, and it's, you know, it's the Fiat Jaffs of Noster that, you know, he doesn't have some Damas big, not even Damas is making that much money in Noster, so I shouldn't use that as an example. But he doesn't have a popular app that everyone uses. He you know, it's protocol level work. So the long-term support program has been geared towards, you know, the spec and protocol level developers that are helping to build out these tools. But it is also applicable to people who are at the application or product level, but have a tenure in proving themselves to be a massive force in terms of, you know, onboarding, adoption of the protocol, or just finding use cases that are, you know, amazing, they've been proven to continue to move the discovery forward. So long-term support is a minimum of 2 years with a automatic renewal, as long as you're, you know, continuing to do the work that you've detailed out in your application. And the application is completely up to you as to what you are doing. We're not dictating what you do. There are no strings attached. You don't have to give us any kind of, you know, performance standards. It's really whatever you set as your work, because that's the way open source work is. It's contributions. You know, we're not a employer. But then the individual grants now, which are not long-term support, are all varies in range. They could be a 12-month long grant. That's usually the longest. They could be a 6-month. They could be a 3-month. It could be a one-time award for a specific project that's being built out, no matter how long you take to build it. All of these things are, you know, negotiable once you've sent in your application. But that is usually a one-off. And every time you have that grant and it's completed, there is no automatic renewal. You have to apply completely new again. Whether or not the work needs to be continued, we would still need a new application. And that new application is going to be looked at with a lot more scrutiny, since, you know, we're not trying to continue to fund especially application level and product level things when they have a path to sustainability or they have a path to profitability. But if you are what we call a tragedy of the commons, where you're creating something that the public in general wants to use and benefits from, but any one particular person that tries to, you know, put their resources towards it or extra resources towards it, that them doing that might negatively impact, you know, themselves or the rest of the public. So a good example I like to give is the drainage in my front yard, right? My front yard has a big drainage. We're in Florida, so a lot of things have flooding issues in the area. And the drainage goes around the entire street across all the houses. And as long as the drainage is working correctly, all the water flows down these gullies, gutters into the big drain and out to the canal. And nobody's yard gets flooded. But each one of these, you need to dig them out if they get blocked up with grass or whatever. If you dig out your yard, you spend the time and dig out your yard just by yourself, then all the water is going to flow into your yard because everybody else didn't dig theirs. And you digging flooded your yard more than anybody else's. Where if everybody dug, then it would all drain into the canal. So it's a tragedy of the commons, right? If you had one person just digging all the yards and keeping them drained, then everyone would benefit. But no one person digging their own yard is gonna make this thing work. So that's where I'm like, okay, well, that would it would be beneficial if someone was getting paid to do that. And I think that's the kind of thing we look for in these technologies, to make sure that it's benefiting all, but there is no like super profitable product here that can be done on, you know, on their own. Like the you know, protocol level stuff, spec level stuff, they need help to build this stuff because no one's going to pay for a product at that level. And I think that's the way we look at most of our applications. Now, again, that's just the core, right? We still didn't talk about education. We still didn't talk about outreach. Mm-hmm. And those things are at the periphery of the application layer. And those, and we even, you know, are thinking about other outside areas that are not necessarily education or outreach either. But our main goal is to make sure that anything that we touch always flows back into the freedom technology and the open source software that we're trying to build, because we've found out from these big companies, big tech today, that big tech is not the way of the future. I think open source software is the way of the future. And if we can build that infrastructure from the ground up and build the peripheral services around it and peripheral education around it, then I think, you know, we're going to win.
Yeah. Amen.
I do want to agree with you on the flooding. I lived in South Florida for a few years of my life, and the flooding would come with the tide sometimes, but anyways, carry on.
And what types of projects, or rather, do you fund individuals or do you fund teams?
So we do a combination. We do fund individuals. We also do fund specific projects, even if that project had multiple individuals contributing to it. And we also, less frequently, we also fund teams and organizations. So any one of these groups of people can apply, whether it's an individual working on a hackathon project that they continued that they think is worth it, or a team or a group of contributors working on a project. Mutiny was a great example of that. Or a company, you know, that maybe already have gotten VC funding, but still has a tragedy of the commons and an open source product that they want help building out. So there's, you know, different levels of different levels of grants that we give in terms of cost, in terms of amount as well. And some are pretty high in terms of the, you know, impact and the visibility that they have. Like it's on our public website, so you can see it. BTC Pay Server is one of the highly visible grants that we've given. Graphene OS, Tor, you know, we have a lot of freedom technology grants that we're proud of. And I would say that if anybody has things they're working on, or any organization or any group of people hacking on something that they feel is important, they should apply. There is no restriction on what type of person or organization you need to be to apply to us.
Avi, how many times do you apply for PCR? Just kidding.
Well, actually, just to getting to that though, or approaching that realm, Dredd. So you talked about the protocol level grants and the application layer grants, and I think those are the ones people are most familiar with. But recently, you announced an education initiative, right? An education fund. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then we can, after that, we can get to what you just alluded to, which is your thinking around going even beyond that potentially into other areas.
Yeah, sure. So, yes, I've been trying to champion, I'm championing education for a long time. And I brought that passion onto the board. And we've finally got, education was always part of our mission from day one. You can see it on our website and on our public statements. But we finally took it off of the back burner and started an education initiative that I lead, where we specifically have a drop down in our application now for education projects and educators specifically. And you know, we appointed a subcommittee of your peers that are in education that help us to select these applications and push them forward to the board so the board can do final votes. These education grants have to be open source, of course. So the common license that's used for content like this is the Creative Commons license, with or without attribution. MIT or GPL licenses are acceptable as well, depending on how you want to protect your content. But it has to be open source. And it also has to be, well, not has to be. I think that's the only has to be, right? the preferred things that will make, that will give you a good application. And this is something that we've talked about on the board as well, about making a nice sample application that people can see, you know, what it looks like, that kind of is our ideal. And that would be also satisfying the tragedy of the commons, also having a online first content leaning perspective, so that anyone in the world can have the opportunity to access your content. And also have a little technical spin to it. Like if you're a developer first education platform or a project, or if you're an educator of developers or an organization that is trying to educate developers or educate kids into learning the technical aspects of Bitcoin or Nostr or Lightning, a lot of these things are favorable, because we're trying to grow the community and we're trying to make awareness, but we are still so early in a lot of these platforms, Bitcoin, Nostr, Lightning, that we want to swell the ranks of core developers, Lightning developers, protocol developers, application developers, and swell the ranks of educators, because without the educators, you're not going to have more developers. So train the trainers are my favorite. But that's the goal, right? Is to make sure that we're not just building things, but we're also building people to build the things and to teach people how to build the things. You know, that whole meta, you know, build a factory that builds a factory type deal is what I'm going for.
And have you given out any education grants? I know the announcement was just a couple of months back. Any grantees yet for that?
Yes. So even when the announcement went out, we had already had a list of grants that were already approved, and then a list of grants that we were also already considering. So we've already given a grant to the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute. For all the Bitcoiners out there that have read anything on Austrian economics or Satoshi, you'd know that that place as an you know, library Alexandria of information in terms of Bitcoin. We've also given multiple grants to Mi Primer Bitcoin, based in El Salvador, and you know, they have nodes all over the world that are spreading amazing information about the Bitcoin diploma that kids can take. We've also given a grant to Summer of Bitcoin, and a few others too. So, and then we have another set of grants in the pipeline that I can't talk about yet since they haven't been announced. But I think that we've moved pretty fast. We funded education in Nigeria. We funded education within the Bitcoin community, you know, the Bitcoin LARP. And I'm excited for the ones that we're going to announce soon too, because it's not just projects and organizations, like I mentioned, but educators, individual educators that we find that have shown themselves to be proven in the community and to help the community, you know, at large. I hope, I don't know, and there is no talk about this, so this is just me, Dread, talking now, but I hope we get to a point where we can have an LTS-like program for educators as well. And I will continue to champion to get to that point. But I think at the pace we're going right now, I'm very happy.
Well, certainly looking forward to what to hearing who the new grantees are, Dread. But for a successful grant application, what is the typical timeline between submission and receiving the funds?
Oh, man, Avi, you're hitting me where it hurts now. We've been very transparent about our strengths and our weaknesses. And one of our weaknesses is turnaround time. Each one of our 9 board members do this completely for free, voluntary work. We are 100% pass-through organization. So every dollar of the donations we get, and we've had very generous donors, every dollar goes to either the general fund or the Noster fund or the operations fund, which is a completely separate set of donations. So, you know, we've had a little bit of bottleneck in terms of being able to wrangle all the board members enough to be able to push hundreds of applications through. And we do get hundreds of applications. We've been constantly improving the process. I do have to thank Gigi for a behemoth of a job that he's done to whip the organization into the shape it is today, handling what we handle. We still have a ways to go. So to answer your question directly, it's probably somewhere between 4 to 5 months is the average turnaround time. There's been turnaround times where we've had, you know, in a month, you know, where we can go from due diligence to subcommittee to board votes asynchronously to an approval on funding. But that's a rare case. It's also a rare case of, you know, 6 months or longer. But I would say that we're probably spanning anywhere from 2, 3, 4, 5 months for someone to go from an application, especially if it's a, you know, not controversial is the wrong word, but an application that warrants discussion, which is the majority, not majority, it's like 50% of them, where we'll have a discussion on the board and it'll take time for people to hash things out. If an application gets all 5 votes out of 9 immediately, it'll go through pretty quickly. But that's also not a very common thing, because we are 5 very individual people with strong personalities and don't agree on everything. We don't agree on many things, which is why it's amazing, right? You're talking about just 9 plebs that otherwise probably wouldn't be in the same room.
Yeah, and what advice do you have for plebs looking for funding? I mean, obviously the application, but anything, any other guidance?
Yes, I love this question because it's something that people don't expect. I would say that apply. Don't wait for the best type of application or the right words to say. Apply, because the application is just the beginning of a conversation. If your application doesn't fit the mission statement or the standards, you're going to get a reply saying so. You're going to be able to, you know, communicate to them what your idea is, what you're trying to do, what your project is doing, or who you are as an educator or who you are as a developer. And as the conversation continues, the application is iterative. It gets edited with things that you, you know, want to communicate to us. And I think that flow, that, you know, open communication really is what either makes or breaks an application. It's much more of an interview process than just an application form you fill in. So I would say start the interview process, you know, get your application in, start talking to us, and let's see if we fit. Let's see if we're a match.
Dredd, I want to go back to one point you made when you were mentioning the education fund, and you said you're potentially looking at going beyond that. What other areas? So obviously, there's application development, there's protocol development, there's education. Are you looking at other avenues that sort of strengthen these open source protocols that are not those three categories?
So, yes. Yes. That's probably as far as I can go without spilling beans that I can't spill yet. But we are
looking alluding to a cultural avenue, Avi?
I'm hoping it's that.
Because culture is upstream of adoption, right, Avi?
That is so I've heard.
I will say that on the technology side, there are other very significant technologies that are bubbling up in the world that we are considering. We are looking at the fact that a lot of these technologies do not have a strong open source component. They might be important enough to pay attention to and to have the open source community play a part in it. I will also say that the education aspect of things was just the beginning of an awareness campaign. We don't know where we'll go from there. We're becoming overworked as it is. And like I said, we're a group of volunteers. So as the organization evolves, we'll iterate on those kind of conversations. But for today, I think the fact that we are firing on all cylinders on our mission from open source Bitcoin Noster education is a win. And anything else after that will come when it's, you know, when it's time. As Arasta said, Arasta is patience and Arasta is love. And I have a lot of both. So I hope that we get to the culture. I was told by a lot of people that, you know, Bitcoin is missing culture. Noster has the culture. Noster keeps it weird as fuck. And I love it. But there is no organization that pushes that, right? So I don't know if there should be one, but I do know that as the individuals come up that are the shining lights of culture, just like the ones that come up that are the shining lights of dev and the shining lights of education, I think those individuals should be recognized and you know, incentivized to continue building those areas out. Will OpenSats become one of them? We'll see.
Mysterious, my friend. Mysterious yet intriguing. But you know, just one of the criticisms, I mean, a lot of happy talk here, Dredd, so we'll just take a brief foray into a tough question, which is, you know, one of the criticisms that I've heard around, you know, I mean, honestly, the amazing work that you do in all of you do, right, in supporting this ecosystem, is that an entity like OpenSats is getting to pick winners and losers. So what would your pushback be? I don't know if you've heard that criticism before, but what would your pushback be to that?
Well, I would definitely say that OpenSats is an open door. It is 9 different individuals that are voting on a 5 of 9 decision to pick that winner or that loser. And we hope that these 9 people on our board represent the community. If that is not the case, we'd love to hear from the community to see if there is a portion of the Bitcoin community, the Noster community, the Lightning community, the open source community, the education community that feels like they're not represented, the global community, not just, you know, in Europe or America. And, you know, we have meetings every quarter. and we discuss the feedback that we get from our from our community and from our donors and from our grantees, and we're willing to grow. Like I said before, we've had our strengths and weaknesses, and we've kept them very transparent, and we've been working on the feedback we've gotten for the length of time it takes to get an approved grant. And I'll also take feedback from the public on how they think we're selecting the grantees. If there is a better way to do it, you know, we're always open to thinking about it, because it'll be a 5 of 9 decision on whether or not we go that direction. But it'll always be a group decision, or a federated decision as to how this happens. There is no one person controlling the winners or the losers in this group. And there is no one, what do you call it? I want to call it an old boys club, but there's nothing like that across our organization, because up until OpenStats, I didn't even know some of these guys, right? And some of them sit on the opposite ends of the aisle on certain topics from me, or from, you know, Matt, or from Ben, when it comes to a lot of things in Bitcoin and Lightning, and even open source, you know, FOSS versus open source versus all the different licenses. We've had, you know, very heated conversations about the nuances around that. So I would love to believe that we represent a wide range of thinking across the community, but I also know that we listen to you guys. So, write to us. And if it takes a long time for us to respond again, I apologize, but don't stop writing. We will be listening and trying to respond to you when we can.
When you said the good old boys club, I was thinking Freemasons, the secret society.
So, Dredd, talk about the last question on OpenStats here. Talk about the long-term outlook for the fund. What are your thoughts on the fund's longevity?
Yeah, I think we started off very idealistic. Ben and Matt have been a North Star in terms of how they wanted this to look and how they wanted to build the organization. And as it's blossomed into this large organization paying out over $700,000 worth of Bitcoin every month to grantees, there's a lot of friction that comes along with it. And what my goal, and I'll speak for myself because, again, I'm one of 9 board members, I can't speak for everyone, but what I would love to see for organization, and what we would love to see as an organization when we talk about it, is for this to be a generational movement, you know, where this is sustainable way past the 9 board members that are here today. You know, like 100 years from now, I'd love if there was some process of rotating board members that allowed the organization to continue without needing to depend on, you know, any one person or any one organization or any one group for it to move forward. And it's kind of the same process that built out the internet, that built out Bitcoin, that built out Nostr, right? It's finding ways to, via consensus and via some kind of proof of work, continue a protocol forward. And my vision for OpenStats is for it to become a protocol of funding going towards FOSS projects. And that protocol just continues to move forward, no matter who's part of it or who's in it. What does that look like in implementation? I'm not sure. But in the long term, that's the way I would love for OpenStats to evolve.
It just struck me, Dredd, 9 folks, lifetime appointments, thinking about ways in how those that can be rotated in and out.
Is this Supreme Court, Avi?
This, yes, KW. It's beginning to sound like the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a reason, right? There's a reason. Magic number 9, when it comes down to this litigation, conversation, voting, it's a powerful number. So, and that's at least 200 years in our world, I suppose. So, Dread, talk to me about One Love Bitcoin. I believe it's a web series and podcast.
Yeah, one of my early passions. This was during my nomadic phase, where I would travel, but I would also meet people. And
back when you had time before you became a father.
Back when the world was different, right? Before I became a father. Before I also started Flash, to be honest. I would say the combination of my son and Flash really made One Love Bitcoin, I'm going to say pause, right? Not end. Because my goal is to interview at least one person from every country and find out what their take on Bitcoin is. I got through about 20-something countries in my web series and got some really amazing guests to tell me about their countries, about their experience with Bitcoin, and about how Bitcoin impacts their country, how it could impact their country. So check it out. It's on One Love Bitcoin on YouTube. I just kind of riff with the guest, and we talk about music because I'm a music head, so I love international music. We always try to play something from their country. And then also try to get them sats. I had a faucet, which is like a, if you know about faucets, it's an LNURLW link where you can just scan with your Lightning address, scan with your Lightning wallet and just get Bitcoin instead of giving it. And I would have a faucet for every interviewee. And they would be able to share it with the people in their country and get free Bitcoin just for coming on the show. I should have done it where it was like, people being able to zap them. But I don't think Noster was very popular when I first started. So I didn't get there. Maybe something in the future, though. One Love Bitcoin is a passion project that I started to help myself to learn about Bitcoin. And I hope to continue it one day.
It is beautiful to learn from interviewees, right? It's a different perspective when you can educate through conversation, especially remarkable people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm experiencing that now. So
I was going to say, KW, it's been that kind of show.
What else are you working on? Anything you want to plug, call to action? Just tell me what's in your crosshairs.
Oh, I mean, I have been a technologist, a futurist for a long time, so I'm always tinkering with some of the bleeding edge stuff in Bitcoin. On the Noster side, it's the DMs. On the Bitcoin side, it's eCash, Fedimint, Liquid. A lot of these different technologies that I'm really excited about. But at the same time, there's nothing else that I would like to plug except, Bitcoin and Noster. If we don't, have a deep and focused drive to continue growing these two discoveries, my concern is that the future could be darker than it needs to be. We have everything we need here. More than everything we need here. And we have passionate people in the community that can help us to grow them. So, the only thing I would say is that I really want to continue seeing it to grow and see my child benefit from it. I hope that he never has to have a dollar bill in his hand. And I hope he never has to sign up for a big tech social media platform. And if that happens in his lifetime, then we've all won. But I've definitely feel like I would have been the big winner. So yeah, nothing to shill except everyone here. Thank you for what you're doing and keep doing it. These shows and these tools are what gets me up in the morning.
Love it, Dread. Well, look, really appreciate you taking the time and dropping all this knowledge on us. Really enjoyed this conversation. And, to the folks listening in the live audience, thank you for joining. Thank you for keeping the chat lively as always. And thank you to the folks listening. I hope you're doing so on Fountain.
Please conversate, boost, zap via Fountain, support value for value. Let's change the world together. Thank you so much, Dread. It was great meeting you, talking to you, and learning your story.
The honor is all mine, QW. Thanks again, Avi. I appreciate it, guys.
All right. With that, see you next week.
Goodbye.